Chapter 6. Thwarting Russia. Defenestrating the INF Treaty. Since my days in George W. Bush's administration, I had wanted to extricate the United States from the INF, Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. This may seem like a tall order, but I had been there before. I knew what to do, having helped Bush 43 get out of the dangerous, outmoded 1972 ABM Treaty, which precluded the U.S. from mounting an effective national missile defense. There was no learning curve, and since one of Helsinki's few tangible outcomes was to be increased cooperation between the U.S. and Russian National Security Councils, the tools were at hand. I proposed to Nikolai Patrushev we meet in Geneva, and he accepted for August 23rd. Russia had been violating the INF Treaty for years, while America stayed in compliance and watched it happen. Barring missiles and launchers with ranges between 500 and 5,500 kilometers, 310 to 3,420 miles, the Reagan-Gorbachev agreement between the U.S. and the USSR was intended to prevent a nuclear war being fought in Europe. Over time, however, the INF's fundamental purpose was vitiated by persistent Russian breaches, changed global strategic realities, and technological progress. Even before Trump took office, Russia had begun actual deployment of missiles violating the INF's prohibitions in the Kaliningrad exclave on the Baltic Sea, laying the basis for a substantial threat to NATO's European members. Moreover, and of even greater long-term consequence, the treaty bound no other countries, apart from, in theory, other USSR successor states, including many of the biggest threats facing the U.S. and its allies. China, for example, had the greatest proportion of its large, growing, already deployed missile capabilities in the INF forbidden range, endangering U.S. allies like Japan and South Korea, as well as India and Russia itself, a fine irony. Iran's intermediate-range ballistic missile force threatened Europe and was poised to expand, as were North Korea's, Pakistan's, India's, and those of other would-be nuclear powers. Finally, the INF Treaty was outdated technologically. While it forbade ground-launched missiles within its prohibited ranges, it did not forbid sea and air-launched missiles from nearby waters or airspace that could hit the same targets as ground-launched missiles. The real bottom line was that the INF Treaty bound only two countries, and one of them was cheating. Only one country in the world was effectively precluded from developing intermediate-range missiles: the United States. It made no sense today, even if it did when adopted in the mid-1980s. Times change, as liberals like to say. Patrushev and I met at the U.S. mission to the UN in Geneva. Beforehand, NSC staff had consulted widely within the U.S. government on the agenda, and Pompeo and I had discussed arms control issues several times. He agreed with my approach to Patrushev. In typical Cold War style, Patrushev and I started with arms control and non-proliferation, particularly Iran and North Korea. The Russians followed Putin's approach in our Moscow meeting, focusing on strategic stability, their foundational phrase for attacking our withdrawal from the ABM Treaty. They asserted, which they had not done in 2001 when we withdrew, that missile defense was inherently destabilizing strategically, and they clearly wanted more detailed negotiations between the two security councils on this proposition. I quickly disabused them of that notion, and then explained again that we had withdrawn from the ABM Treaty to deal, at least initially, with threats to the homeland from emerging nuclear weapons states and accidental launches from Russia and China. Patrushev said our respective levels of trust would define how successful we will be, pointing to the INF Treaty, where he claimed there were conflicting claims of compliance. That was pure propaganda. Russia had been violating the INF Treaty for well over a decade, a point made repeatedly during the Obama administration to no avail whatever. As with all U.S. treaties, the Defense and State Departments were overgrown with lawyers. We couldn't violate a treaty if we wanted to. As usual, the Russians had a long list of alleged U.S. violations to discuss in excruciating detail. We had an even longer list of actual Russian violations I emphatically did not want to waste time on. We considered the theoretical possibility of universalizing the INF by bringing in China, Iran, and others, but it was a fantasy that they would voluntarily destroy large quantities of their existing missile arsenals, which would be necessary to comply with the treaty's terms. Instead, I wanted to make clear that U.S. withdrawal from the INF was a real possibility, even though there was no official U.S. position, something that must have astounded them. I also said it was unlikely we could agree to a 5-year extension of Obama's New Start, which Moscow and most U.S. liberals were praying for. There were many reasons not to succumb to a knee-jerk extension, including the need to involve China in strategic weapons negotiations for the first time, a view that I could see took the Russians by surprise. We also needed to cover tactical nuclear weapons, which New START did not, and new technologies being pursued aggressively by Russia and China, such as hypersonic glide vehicles that were only in the early stages of design when New START was adopted in 2010, as I explained at some length. Finally, we needed to consider returning to the conceptually far simpler model of the 2002 Treaty of Moscow, negotiated by yours truly. There was much more to cover, but this was a good start. After Geneva, I went to Kiev to participate in Ukraine's Independence Day ceremonies and to confer with President Petro Poroshenko, his prime minister, and other officials. I briefed them on the INF discussions, which directly affected their defense planning. Who knew that just over a year later, Ukraine would figure so centrally in U.S. politics? On returning to Washington, I spent the next months preparing for the dramatic step of INF withdrawal. To prevent leaks that would agitate the press and foreign policy establishment, I thought we should pursue a quiet, low-profile but expedited approach rather than endless meetings among staffers who had lived with the INF treaty their entire government careers and couldn't bear to see it die. Trump, I believed, was on board, although I was never certain he understood the INF treaty did not regulate nuclear weapons as such, but only their delivery vehicles. I wanted to launch U.S. withdrawal from the treaty, which would be an important signal to China, among others, or possibly even mutual withdrawal, before my next meeting with Patrushev in Moscow in late October. Experience taught me that without action-forcing deadlines, bureaucracies could resist change with incredible tenacity and success. We also needed to prepare our NATO allies for the INF's demise. Too many European political leaders believed they lived beyond the end of history and that nothing external should be allowed to roil their contented continent. It was a nice thought. Tell it to Russia and China, not to mention all Europe's good friends in Iran. An example of the conversations we needed to have took place on October 3rd with German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas. Maas, a social democrat, was part of Merkel's coalition and doubtless an INF supporter. I didn't say how far along our thinking was, but I emphasized that Europe was already under growing threat as Russia proceeded unchallenged. I also explained why we wouldn't be discussing strategic stability with Moscow, meaning what Russia didn't like about America's national missile defense program, which we had no intention of negotiating, let alone modifying or abandoning. The best news came when Mattis and I had breakfast in the wardroom a couple of days later, Pompeo being away, following a just-concluded NATO defense ministers' meeting. He had explained at length to his counterparts that Russia was in material breach of the INF, and he believed they fully understood. Mattis recommended that Pompeo repeat these arguments the first week in December at the NATO foreign ministers' meeting, giving Russia, say, 90 days to return to compliance with the treaty, or the U.S. would withdraw. I thought we should skip the 90-day pause, since there was no way Russia was coming back into compliance. Besides, The treaty itself provided, following notice of withdrawal, a 6-month waiting period before withdrawal became effective. This was a standard provision in international agreements, basically the same as the ABM treaty clause we invoked in 2001. With that built-in waiting period, there was no reason to give Moscow more time to sow further confusion and uncertainty among the Europeans. I urged we give notice and start the 180-day withdrawal clock running. At one of our weekly breakfasts on October 11th, Mattis, Pompeo, and I confirmed we still all favored withdrawal. Mattis, however, was averse to mutual withdrawal, fearing it implied moral equivalence. None of us believed there was moral equivalence, and notwithstanding Mattis's point, mutual withdrawal would give Trump something he could announce as a success with Russia, perhaps thereby reducing the pressure to make real concessions in other areas. I called NATO's Secretary General Stoltenberg that afternoon and explained where we were headed. He stressed we shouldn't give Russia the pleasure of dividing us, especially from Germany. I agreed, but explained to Stoltenberg and all who would listen that U.S. withdrawal from the INF didn't threaten Europe. What was threatening were Russian violations of the treaty and the capability they now possessed to strike most of Europe with INF non-compliant missiles. Stoltenberg asked what we understood material breach to mean and whether we had totally given up on Russia coming back into compliance. As to material breach, I thought Mattis's presentation at the defense minister's meeting had proved materiality by anyone's definition. As for Russia, did anyone seriously believe they would junk existing assets that violated the treaty, especially since China's growing missile threat along its Asian borders was likely driving Moscow as much or more than what it was seeking to achieve in Europe? Stoltenberg was optimistic that we could play our cards right on this issue. On October 17th, before my meeting with Patrushev in Moscow the following week, I briefed Trump on where things stood, including all the interagency work we had done, our preliminary diplomacy with NATO allies and others, and our likely schedule for withdrawal, kicked off on December 4th by Pompeo's giving Russia notice to resume compliance or else. Trump responded, "Why do we have to wait so long? Why can't we just get out?" I said I was certainly ready. I explained that once we announced our intention to withdraw, the Russians would likely do the same, accusing us of violating the treaty, which was untrue, but which could involve us in a series of recriminatory statements between Moscow and Washington. Instead, I suggested, why didn't I ask Patrushev that the two countries withdraw mutually? This approach could spare us a lot of grief and allow us to announce an agreement with Russia on something of importance. Trump, however, said, "I don't want to do that. I just want to get out." I had thought mutually withdrawing would be a more appealing route to Trump, but if not so, so be it. For myself, I couldn't have cared less what Moscow did. I left Joint Base Andrews on Saturday, flying uneventfully for all of 20 minutes, until we saw that, responding to a reporter's question at an Elko, Nevada campaign rally, Trump had said we were leaving the INF treaty. My first thought was, well, that settles that. It wasn't the timing that Mattis, Pompeo, and I had agreed on, but apparently Trump had decided that now was better, subject, of course, to the treaty's 180-day waiting period. I immediately called Sanders in Washington, who hadn't heard Trump's remark, and suggested we quickly draft a statement to embody his comment, with which she agreed. I then called Pompeo, who said it was horrific Trump could make an announcement as significant as withdrawing from the INF just in response to a reporter's question, a rare occasion of Pompeo's being explicitly critical of something Trump did. I didn't agree, since all he had really done was accelerate our timetable, which was fine with me. As long as the decision was public, we might as well give formal notice of withdrawal to start the 6-month clock ticking. I said we should also announce the immediate suspension of our treaty obligations, thus allowing us to begin the race to catch up to Russia, China, and other INF-capable countries. I had the NSC staff on the plane with me start calling their colleagues at State and Defense to get busy on drafting and clearing a statement. Unfortunately, the statement never got issued for reasons I do not even now understand, but almost certainly because Mattis and possibly Pompeo didn't want to act on what Trump had already publicly said. After refueling at Shannon, Ireland, we headed off to Moscow, and I called Stoltenberg Sunday morning Europe time. He had by then heard about Trump's statement. I explained what had happened and that now we would simply accelerate our consultations with allies and others because we obviously couldn't walk back what Trump had said openly. Stoltenberg was worried that, as of now, a NATO resolution on withdrawal would not be unanimous, and he wanted time to make it so. That was fine, since none of us had contemplated a NATO resolution this early anyway. Stoltenberg wasn't as panicky as some Europeans, but he was obviously nervous. I said I would report back after my meetings with the Russians. When I landed in Moscow, Ambassador John Huntsman met me and said the Russians were agitating, playing on Europeans' fears we were abandoning them, leaving them defenseless. This line had also swept Europe during the ABM treaty withdrawal. It hadn't been true then, and it wasn't true now. Someone should have said, "Steady in the ranks, Europeans." In any case, I still don't know why Trump had made his Nevada comments or why the statement elaborating on them hadn't been issued. Inexplicably, Ricardel received word of a 4 p.m. Sunday meeting with Trump at the residence requested by Mattis. I called Pompeo, who didn't understand why the meeting was urgent even after speaking with Mattis on Saturday. Pompeo believed Mattis would ask to return to our original timetable for announcing the withdrawal, not for reopening the underlying decision. Since Trump had already effectively made the announcement, I didn't see how to roll it back, and Pompeo agreed. There was no dispute we needed more discussions with our allies, but we were now in a fundamentally different position than before Trump's comments. Why not, therefore, file notice of withdrawal, suspend our treaty obligations, and get moving? Pompeo said that was what Mattis wanted to avoid, which led me to wonder if Mattis really only wanted to slow the pace of withdrawal, or if he had changed his mind on withdrawing and was now trying to play for time. I could imagine that Washington's high-minded were already on the phone to Mattis, and I was intrigued he hadn't bothered to call me, rushing instead to schedule a weekend meeting when I was out of town. I asked Pompeo what he thought about the timing issue. He said he was agnostic and could live with it either way. My meeting with Patrushev the next day was at 1A Alsufievsky Pereulok, which he happily described as the former headquarters of the FSB's Alpha Group of the Spetsnaz, or Special Forces, formed by the KGB in 1974. Alpha Group was a counter-terrorism task force, helping remind us, I thought, of Patrushev's prior role as head of the FSB. We again started off with arms control, as the Russians solemnly advised us that official Russian doctrine had no plans to use military power for offensive goals and that defensive power was the key to strategic stability. Patrushev explained why they didn't want us to exit the INF, noting the critiques of our decision by certain of our helpful European allies. In response, I laid out the reasons we felt Russia was in violation and why the capabilities of China, Iran, and others made it impossible to universalize the treaty as we had once thought possible. Former Foreign Minister Igor Ivanov best summed up the Russian reaction. "If you want to leave, go ahead, but Russia will stay in." That was fine by me. We were then treated to a lecture on our alleged violations of New START. For the second time, I explained to Patrushev and his delegation why it was unlikely we would simply extend New START, given the ratification debates, where many Republicans objected that key issues, such as tactical nuclear weapons, were not addressed at all. I pressed again for a 2002 Treaty of Moscow format, which was simpler, clearer, and had worked well. Patrushev did not dismiss the idea. Instead, he stressed that the 2002 treaty was more complicated than it seemed because it relied on START II verification provisions, which was not quite true, but I didn't take time to revisit the issue. What struck me was that even with the INF disappearing, they seemed willing to consider the 2002 model. There might yet be hope. Late in the afternoon, with the day's meetings concluded except for a dinner hosted by Foreign Minister Lavrov at Osobnyak, I called Ricardel to see what had happened at the Sunday meeting with Trump. She said Mattis had started with a filibuster on the 18-month plan he had to withdraw from the INF, which was now in shreds. He wanted to return to where we were before Trump spoke in Nevada and put out a press statement to that effect. I still couldn't comprehend how we could roll the clock back, pretending we were consulting about whether to leave the treaty or that Russia might take some action to return to compliance, as to which there was not the slightest hint. What was the purpose of this charade? Trump said he didn't see any reason not to proceed with withdrawing, as he had said, but he didn't object to making a formal announcement on December 4th, which was contradictory and ignored the new reality his own statement had created. After the Trump meeting, Mattis, Pompeo, and Ricardel argued over Mattis's draft statement, which at best muddied the waters, but which in fact was aimed at rolling back what Trump had said. I told Ricardel to do everything she could to kill it. The whole thing baffled me, but Trump made it even more moot, if that was possible, later in the day Monday, in another of his customary press encounters as he left the south entrance to board Marine One. He said, "I'm terminating the agreement. Russia violated it. I'm terminating it." Asked if that was a threat to Putin, Trump answered, "It's a threat to whoever you want. It includes China, and it includes Russia, and whoever wants to play that game. You can't play that game on me." What else was there to say? I didn't realize it at the time, but I wondered later, with Mattis's resignation just 2 months away, whether this was his attempt at legacy creation to show he had fought to the end to preserve the INF. The whole affair was a waste of time and energy, not to mention confusing to foreign friend and foe alike. I spoke with Pompeo later in the afternoon, and he insisted that Mattis was not really seeking any change in policy. I felt far away and frustrated, but I determined I would continue working to minimize the available time for opponents of our withdrawal to undo what Trump had already now said twice publicly. At about 4 p.m. Moscow time, I called Trump, and he confirmed that he couldn't see what all the fuss was about or why Mattis thought it was so important. I told Trump I was telling the Russians he had clearly stated we were getting out, and Trump said, "I like our way of doing it." That was all I needed. The next day, I met with Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu. With respect to the INF, he appeared less concerned than Mattis. He said, through an interpreter, that Trump's message was unambiguous and that the Russians had heard it clearly. He went further, saying that under current circumstances, a reasonable man could see the situation under the INF treaty was unrealistic because of China and changes in technology since the 1987 INF. Shoigu favored trying to rewrite the treaty to get others to join it because he thought our unilateral withdrawal was favorable only to our common enemies, which he repeated later. I thought the implicit reference to China was unmistakable. Shoigu added that it had been a while since it was signed, and the challenge was that the technologies were in the possession of countries that shouldn't have them. I remember him concluding by agreeing that the effectiveness of the treaty had expired. This was the most sensible thing anyone in Russia said on the issue. Interestingly, Shoigu and Mattis had never met, and indeed, as of then, Pompeo and Lavrov had not yet met. And here I was talking to these Russians all the time. That afternoon, Huntsman and I placed a wreath on a bridge near the Kremlin, less than 100 yards from St. Basil's Cathedral, where Boris Nemtsov had been murdered, many believed by Kremlin operatives.
We then placed a wreath at Russia's Tomb of the Unknown Soldier along the Kremlin Wall, a ceremony I had first attended with Donald Rumsfeld almost exactly 18 years earlier. My meeting with Putin followed right afterward, beginning precisely the same as the prior meeting, same ornately decorated room, same arrangements, same conference table. Putin was obviously determined to make the point, while the media was present, that he was unhappy the U.S. had withdrawn from the INF Treaty. He noted that the eagle in the Great Seal of the United States is clutching olive branches in one talon, although he failed to note the eagle is clutching arrows in the other, and asked if the eagle had eaten all the olives. I said I hadn't brought any new olives with me. So much for Soviet-style banter. Once the press exited, Putin said he had received reports on my earlier meetings and that their side valued our contacts a lot and that it was always a pleasure to meet with me. We discussed our respective positions on the INF at length, but what really interested Putin was what comes next, meaning what were we contemplating regarding deployment in Europe? Having made the point earlier that Russia and America were effectively the only two countries bound by the INF, I replied that I thought Putin had said at our last meeting that Russia understood the strategic implications of that fact, meaning China's large and growing ballistic and hypersonic glide missile capabilities. Putin agreed that he had acknowledged the China issue, but said he had not mentioned wishing to pull out of the INF, agreeing with my point that Russia and the United States were the only two countries bound by the treaty. As for now, he continued, withdrawal was not the most important point, but rather what Washington's future plans would be. As I would reiterate in my subsequent press conference, I told him that the U.S. had not yet made any final decisions regarding future deployments. Obviously, Putin was most worried about what we might deploy in Europe, and later that week, he saw a way to intimidate the Europeans by implying we were returning to the mid-1980s confrontation over deploying U.S. Pershing II missiles. Putin made that very point publicly, threatening to target any country that accepted U.S. missiles non-compliant with INF terms. Of course, Russia was already doing just that through its deployments in Kaliningrad, among other things, which was a major reason we were exiting the treaty. Putin recalled that both of us were lawyers, saying, "We could go on talking like this until dawn." And we then exchanged jokes about lawyers. On New Start, we reviewed our respective positions, and I again pressed the benefits of reverting to a Treaty of Moscow-type agreement. Why go through the agony of renegotiating New Start, adding, for example, reductions or limitations on tactical nuclear weapons, which were of major importance to the U.S., given the large number of such weapons Russia had? In response to Putin's questions, I said we had no intention of withdrawing from New Start, but we were also essentially certain not to allow it simply to be extended for 5 years, as Russia was asking, along with almost all Senate Democrats. Fortunately, we avoided long discussions of who was and who was not violating the INF or New Start. But I urged that such detours showed how disruptive such treaties could be, rather than advancing the much-touted objective of easing tensions. On Syria, Putin emphasized that Russians had no need of an Iranian presence, and that the right thing for both of us to do was to incentivize them to leave. He mentioned that he had discussed the topic with Netanyahu. I pointed out that having withdrawn from the Iran nuclear deal, the U.S. was reimposing sanctions on Iran, which we expected to bite sharply, and they were not tradable just to get Iran out of Syria. Putin said that he understood our logic and acknowledged our view that the people of Iran were tired of the regime. He cautioned, however, that if we declared war against them economically, it would consolidate support for the regime. I explained why we didn't see it that way, and why strong sanctions would reduce support for the regime, which was already under enormous stress. Putin also acknowledged that we each had our theories about how to deal with Iran, and we would see which one worked out. Putin joked at our expense over Saudi Arabia and the Khashoggi murder, saying Russia would sell the Saudis arms if we didn't, which was undoubtedly correct and underscored why Trump didn't want to renounce our pending arms sales. We ended at about 7:05, after an hour and three quarters. Putin subsequently told Trump at the November 11th Armistice Day centenary in Paris that he and I had a nice conversation in Moscow and that I was very professional and specific. Not that that had any impact on Trump. As we were shaking hands goodbye, Putin smiled and said he saw that I was going to the Caucasus. I returned home feeling that Russia, always happy to pin the blame on us, especially with perennially nervous Europeans, would run a pro forma opposition campaign against our INF withdrawal, irritating but not threatening. I did not foresee a major propaganda effort or anything that could frustrate our ultimate withdrawal. In the meantime, briefings to NATO allies in Brussels and in capitals were going well. Flying back from Tbilisi, my last stop, I spoke to Stoltenberg, who said more and more allies now understood the logic of our position. He also said, however, that several countries still resisted admitting that Russia was violating the INF because they were afraid that if they agreed the Russians were in violation, it might mean that one day down the road they therefore might have to accept nuclear weapons on their territory. This was crazy, in my view. NATO allies were prepared to deny reality because they feared the consequences of admitting it. Did they really believe if they didn't admit it, it wouldn't be true? Many pressed for more delay before withdrawal, a thinly veiled way to buy time to prevent it altogether, which is why Mattis's palpable obstructionism worried me. In Paris, for the Armistice Day centenary in November, I met with Sedwill, Etienne, and Jan Hecker, our German counterpart, to discuss Germany's desire for another 60-day delay in our withdrawal. I didn't agree to it, especially given Trump's evident desire to exit sooner rather than later. But the issue remained unresolved. At a mid-November Association of Southeast Asian Nations summit in Singapore, where I accompanied Vice President Pence, we had an impromptu pull-aside bilateral with Putin in a corner of the large conference room. We were surrounded by Secret Service and other security personnel, so we drew a lot of attention as others were departing. Pence wanted to raise the issue of Russian election meddling, but the discussion quickly turned elsewhere. Putin asked where things stood on meeting with Trump at the upcoming G20 meeting in Argentina to discuss strategic stability and New START, which would certainly be interesting. Putin seemed to have lost interest in the INF, saying to me, through an interpreter, that he understood our arguments and logic on the decision to withdraw from the INF, which I took to be an acknowledgement of our shared view on China. I said we would get back to them on scheduling for the G20. Germany, however, continued to press for delay, so I explained to Trump on November 26th that we should announce withdrawal at the December 4th NATO Foreign Ministers meeting rather than give Germany another 60 days. Russia was still trying to intimidate the Europeans, and the risk of further delays was simply not worth it. Trump agreed, also now worried that further delays would make us look weak in Russia's eyes. Trump was in the right place. The next day, we were at it again, in a meeting with Trump on other subjects, when Mattis advocated the German position of an additional 60 days delay. Was he working some unspoken agenda? I urged Trump yet again to pull the trigger on December 4th, and he said, "I agree. This is going to be a win for John. We'll announce withdrawal on December 4th. I then pressed him to announce simultaneously the suspension of our treaty obligations because of Russia's material breach, a concept separate from withdrawal, which would allow us to begin violating the treaty even as the 180-day clock was ticking, and Trump agreed. Kelly, also present, asked, "So the full Monty, sir?" And Trump said, "Yes." But, of course, it wasn't really over, and at the Buenos Aires G20 on December 1st, Merkel took one more shot in her bilateral with Trump. She said she completely agreed that Russia was in violation, but complained that there had been no political talks between Russia and the U.S., which was nonsense, since we had held just such talks not only under Trump, but even under Obama. Trump asked what I thought, and I urged him again to proceed as planned, giving notice of withdrawal on December 4th. Trump said he didn't want to look weak to Russia, and Merkel promised she would back us if we gave her 60 days. After several more minutes of back and forth, Trump said he agreed with me, but nonetheless would give Merkel the 2 months she wanted, so long as we could definitely leave the INF then. Pompeo and I stressed that it was just 2 months, and Merkel agreed. I then urged that at that point in time, the Germans would say they support our decision to withdraw and not use some other word, like understand, which Hecker had previously tried with me, and Merkel agreed. I figured that was all I could get, but it was precious little compared to the potential agony we might endure by pulling the Band-Aid off slowly. We discussed explaining this to NATO allies, and Trump proposed saying, "At the request of Germany and others, we will terminate the INF treaty 60 days from now." It struck me he still didn't appreciate the 180-day clock that had to run before withdrawal actually took effect, but it was too late by then to reopen the discussion. The December 4th announcement went well, and we filed notice of withdrawal on February 1st, 2019. The Russians announced immediate suspension of any new arms control negotiations, an unexpected side benefit. The high priest of U.S. arms controllers called me a nuclear arms agreement hitman, which I took as a compliment. There was some fussing as the months wore on, but at 12:01 a.m. on Friday, August 2nd, the U.S. broke free of the INF Treaty. A great day. Other bilateral and multilateral treaties involving Russia and the United States should also come under the axe, not to mention numerous multilateral agreements the U.S. has unwisely made. Trump, for example, readily agreed to unsign the Obama-era arms trade treaty, which had never been ratified by the Senate, but which anti-gun control groups in the U.S. had long opposed, dating back to my days as an undersecretary of state in the Bush 43 administration. Speaking to the annual NRA convention on April 26, 2019 in Indianapolis, Trump received a standing ovation while he actually unsigned the agreement right in front of the audience. Trump also unsigned the Paris Agreement on climate change, a move which I supported. That deal had all of the real-world impact on climate change of telling your prayer beads and lighting candles in church, which someone will try to forbid soon because of the carbon footprint of all those burning candles. The agreement simply requires signatories to set national goals, but doesn't say what those goals should be, nor does it contain enforcement mechanisms. This is theology masquerading as policy, an increasingly common phenomenon in international affairs. The list of other agreements to discard is long, including the Law of the Sea Convention and two others from which the U.S. should be immediately unshackled. The 1992 Treaty on Open Skies, which only entered into force in 2002, in theory allows unarmed military surveillance flights over the territories of its 30-plus signatories, but has been contentious since its inception. It has proven a boon to Russia, but is outdated and essentially valueless to the United States, because we no longer need to overfly their territory. Withdrawing the U.S. would clearly be in our national interest, denying Russia, for example, the ability to conduct low-altitude flights over Washington, D.C. and other highly sensitive locations. When I resigned, consideration was underway regarding leaving open skies, and press reports indicated these efforts, which I still fully support, were continuing. Similarly, unsigning the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty should be a priority, so the United States can once again conduct underground nuclear testing. We have not tested nuclear weapons since 1992, and while we have extensive programs to verify the safety and reliability of our stockpile, there is no absolute certainty without testing. We never ratified the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, but we are caught in international law limbo. Article 18 of the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, arguably based on customary international law, provides that a country that has signed but not ratified a treaty is prohibited from taking actions that would defeat the object and purpose of the treaty. Unsigning the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty would make it clear the U.S. will make future judgments on underground nuclear testing based on its own national interests. Ironically, the U.S. has signed but never ratified the Vienna Convention, and the applicability of customary international law is subject to heated debate. Other nuclear powers, like China and India, have either not ratified or not signed the treaty, which is why it still has not entered into force. The U.S. has unsigned other treaties, most notably under Bush 43, when we unsigned the Rome Statute establishing the International Criminal Court. Protecting U.S. elections from acts of war. During the 2016 campaign, I called Russian efforts to interfere in the elections an act of war against our constitutional structures, and I watched with dismay reports of Putin's meeting with Trump at the 2017 G20 meeting in Hamburg, Germany, where Putin flatly denied any Russian interference. We needed not just a law enforcement response to international cyber threats, but substantial military and clandestine capabilities as well. Accordingly, one of the first things I addressed was our ability to undertake offensive cyber operations against our adversaries, including terrorist groups and other non-state actors. There was a long, simmering struggle underway between those who favored the Obama administration's approach, believing that only defensive cyber efforts, with the rarest of exceptions, were sufficient, versus the more robust view that offensive capabilities were crucial. Obama's strategy rested on the fallacy that cyberspace was relatively benign, even unspoiled, and that the best approach was to smooth over the problems and not risk making things worse. I didn't understand why cyberspace should be materially different from the rest of human experience. Initially, a state of anarchy from which strength and resolve, backed by substantial offensive weaponry, could create structures of deterrence against potential adversaries that would eventually bring peace. If, as we knew with increasing certainty, Russia, China, North Korea, Iran, and others were contesting us in cyberspace, it was time to fight back. Such a strategy was not designed to increase conflict in this new domain, but to restrain it. In reality, a defense-only strategy guaranteed more provocations, more conflict, and more damage to both businesses and other private entities, as well as to the U.S. government. This forward-leaning approach was hardly revolutionary. Before I arrived in the West Wing, there were extensive interagency discussions to change the Obama-era rules governing cyber decision-making. These rules so centralized authority for cyber offense and were so bureaucratically burdensome that actual offensive cyber actions under Obama were rare. By stressing process rather than policy, Obama inhibited U.S. operations in cyberspace without ever having to say so explicitly, thereby evading the legitimate public debate we should have been having over this new war-fighting domain. Unfortunately, bureaucratic inertia, turf fights, and some genuine unresolved issues paralyzed the Trump administration month after month. That had to change. One of the first things I did was clarify lines of authority within the NSC staff dealing with national and homeland security issues, since they were, at bottom, exactly the same thing. I also swept away duplicative, competitive billets and fiefdoms, and made it possible for the NSC staff to speak with one voice. With the deadwood cleared away, we were off, although incredibly frustrating bureaucratic battles and obstructionism still lay ahead. We needed to do two things. First, we needed a Trump administration cyber strategy, and second, we needed to scrap the Obama-era rules and replace them with a more agile, expeditious decision-making structure. Considerable work had already been done by the time I arrived, but it still took an enormous effort to make the last few bureaucratic first downs to achieve finality. I often thought that if our bureaucrats struggled as hard against our foreign adversaries as they did against each other when turf issues were at stake, we could all rest a lot easier. Despite considerable hard slogging, it still took 5 months until September 20th before we could make the new cyber strategy public. Although our determination to enable offensive cyber operations got the headlines, the overall strategy was comprehensive, thoughtful, and a good beginning. Even an Obama administration cyber expert said, "This document shows what a national strategy can look like on an issue that truly is nonpartisan. It strikes a good balance between defensive actions and seeking to impose consequences on malicious actors. Further, it's clear that this strategy is a reflection of a strong policy development process across administrations." Revamping that strategy was hard enough, but shredding the old rules was actually even harder. The interagency process was frozen solid. The Department of Homeland Security and others wanted to keep a stranglehold on the Defense Department, as did the intelligence community. The Pentagon didn't want oversight from anyone, including the White House, and took an all-or-nothing approach in negotiations that only infuriated everyone else involved. As a result, policy positions had become ever more hardened in the 18 months since the administration began. I felt like Ulysses S. Grant before Richmond, saying, "I propose to fight it out on this line if it takes all summer," which looked optimistic. Mattis repeatedly claimed we wouldn't be able to undertake any offensive cyber operations before the November elections, which he knew was my top priority if his view didn't prevail, which was standard operating procedure for him. Stressed that the timing was urgent, which is what Mattis said when it suited him, and predict doom and gloom if he didn't get his way. We needed to move. On August 7th, we had a principals committee meeting that I opened by saying that for 19 months, after scores of unproductive lower-level meetings, the Trump administration had failed to replace Obama's rules. We now had a draft presidential memorandum that gave policymakers more flexibility and discretion, but without excluding from decision-making those with legitimate stakes in the outcome. I said that if there were still dissents, I would put them before the president to get a decision. That got everyone's attention. As in many of these cabinet-level meetings, however, several of the principals could only speak from prepared talking points, relying on their staff to help them. I felt that there should be a rule that if it wasn't important enough for cabinet secretaries personally to understand the issues, they should not be in the meeting at all. Mattis still wanted major changes, but Gina Haspel, Sue Gordon, Dan Coates' deputy, and Jeff Sessions, and the FBI, all liked the draft as it was. Pompeo and Mnuchin had little to say but did not disagree. Unfortunately, Mattis either couldn't or wouldn't explain the reasons for the changes he wanted. In the administration's first year plus, I had been told, the common pattern was that Mattis would hold forth, Tillerson would agree, everyone else would fold without significant comment, thereby ending the meeting. That may have worked earlier, but I wasn't having it. I ended the meeting saying we had broad consensus on the way ahead, even if Mattis didn't agree, and I hoped we could move rapidly to finalize the draft decision memorandum. Mattis left quickly, but defense lawyers and others hung around and agreed we were very close to something the department could live with, Mattis notwithstanding. Over the next few days of detailed negotiations, Mattis remained obdurate, and there was some backsliding by elements of the intelligence community, which was jealous of the National Security Agency's authority. This reflected a long-standing, almost existential, CIA-Pentagon tension. Nonetheless, I told Trump we were making progress. After internal White House bureaucratic delays too tedious and inexplicable to recount, on August 15th, Trump signed our directive and we were launched. We focused initially on election-related matters to get a fast start on creating deterrence against interference not only in 2018, but also in future U.S. elections. Other steps would follow to lay the foundation for a comprehensive cyber capability. We also drafted a new executive order under existing presidential authorities, making it easier to carry out sanctions against foreign efforts to interfere with elections. This avoided obtaining new legislation, which almost certainly would have been gridlocked in partisan wrangling. Even some Republicans, fearful of Trump's weak responses to Russian provocations, wanted to pursue legislation, but we patiently explained why our executive order would actually be more effective without the partisan sniping any legislation would inevitably produce. Most important, there was no guarantee Congress could even get its act together before the 2018 election, and the imperative had to be moving quickly. On September 12th, sitting in his small dining room with a number of people discussing the Mexico border wall issue, I explained to Trump the thinking behind the executive order. It was a way to show our diligence and rebut criticisms about the administration's not being aggressive in defending election integrity, as well as to hold off ill-advised action by Congress. He asked, "Whose idea is this?" And I said it was mine. Whereupon he said, "Oh," and signed the order. As Shahira Knight, then the White House Director of Legislative Affairs, said to me later, happy to have the prospect of elections legislation effectively foreclosed, "Congratulations. That was amazing." By the end of September, we had a substantial election security policy framework in place, and we could accelerate our efforts to safeguard the November 2018 elections. Not that we hadn't already been hard at work on defenses well beyond cybersecurity alone. Just a month after I arrived, on May 3, 2018, Sessions, FBI Director Wray, Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen, Director of National Intelligence Coates, and others briefed Trump on what was already underway to increase security for November. Trump wanted the operating agencies to be more visible in generating news about the extensive work being done, which the media was underreporting. And indeed, the departments and agencies themselves felt they were doing a good job. They knew what the threat was, and no one was holding them back from trying to defend against it. We held a second NSC meeting on July 27th to take another look at our efforts, with all the operating agencies reporting they were substantially better prepared than they had been at this stage of the 2016 campaign, and much more aware of the kinds of threats they would face in their respective areas. We followed up this NSC meeting with a briefing in the White House press room on August 2nd, featuring Coates, Nielsen, Wray, General Paul Nakasone, director of the National Security Agency, which was also the home of U.S. Cyber Command, and myself. Each official told the story of what their agency was doing, which we should have done earlier, and the briefing was well received, if grudgingly, by the press. One story called the briefing an administration show of force to prove we were actually doing something on election meddling. Unable to criticize the adequacy of the overall effort, the media therefore turned to saying Trump was following one policy and we were following another. Unfortunately, there was something to that, as Trump repeatedly objected to criticizing Russia and pressed us not to be so critical of Russia publicly. All this preparatory work was essential, especially because it might be necessary to brief Congress on particular threats. Within the limited group of agencies that had offensive cyber interests at stake, there were clear divisions of opinion on what to share with Congress and how quickly it would get into the press. These were often complex issues, since one of our adversaries' objectives was not just to affect particular elections, but to sow fear and mistrust throughout the body politic, thus undermining citizen confidence in the integrity of the system as a whole. With uncertain, incomplete information from which hard conclusions did not immediately emerge, it could cause more damage to disclose it prematurely and too broadly, thus risking its becoming ammunition in partisan political battles. I did not believe we should be doing the attackers' work for them, spreading misinformation, whether to Congress or campaigns potentially under attack. Fortunately, foreign interference was sufficiently reduced in 2018 that the few incidents we had were ultimately resolved satisfactorily. But it was clear that the posterior covering instincts of some officials and bureaucracies were potentially serious problems if the stakes ever increased. The Trump administration had imposed substantial new economic sanctions on Russian citizens and entities in 2017, related to the Crimea annexation, adding to what Obama had done, as well as extending other sanctions, closed the Russian consulates in San Francisco and Seattle, expelled more than 60 Russian intelligence agents operating in the U.S. as diplomats after Moscow's attack on the Skripals, imposed sanctions for violating the Chemical and Biological Weapons Control and Warfare Elimination Act, also required by the attack on the Skripals, sanctioned Russia's Internet Research Agency, an arm of Russia's cyber offense machinery, and penalized over 36 Russian officials for violations of U.S.-Syria-related sanctions. As new violations were uncovered, further sanctions were imposed on each person and corporate entity involved. Trump touted these as major achievements, but almost all of them occasioned opposition, or at least extended grumbling and complaining from Trump himself. One example involved the sanctions related to the chemical weapons attack on the Skripals. This statute had only recently been used for the first time after Kim Jong-un ordered his half-brother murdered in Malaysia via chemical weapons, and after the Assad regime's chemical weapons attacks in Syria. There was criticism that the sanctions imposed were not sweeping enough, but Trump objected to having any sanctions at all. Trump finally approved sanctions before the Helsinki summit, but postponed announcing them until the summit ended. We explained to Trump that these sanctions were only the first in what was likely a series, since the applicable statute provided for ever more stringent sanctions if the accused nation did not provide convincing evidence it had given up chemical and/or biological weapons, including allowing international inspectors to verify compliance. No one believed Russia would do so. When Helsinki concluded, state announced the sanctions since no new decision was required. Trump, upon hearing the news, wanted to rescind them. I wondered if this entire crisis was caused by Rand Paul's recent visit to Moscow, which generated significant press coverage for him, and where the Russians doubtless stressed that they were very unhappy about the sanctions. This was ironic, with libertarian politicians like Paul so worried about the Kremlin's tender sensibilities. Hearing of the controversy, Mnuchin called Pompeo and me to blame us for not telling him about the new sanctions, which was inaccurate because the sanctions had previously gone through a National Security Council review process without objection from anyone. Within hours, Trump concluded he was relaxed about this particular decision, but he still thought we were being too tough on Putin. Trump told Pompeo to call Lavrov and say some bureaucrat had published the sanctions, a call that may or may not have ever taken place. In addition to objecting to sanctions, Trump stopped an anodyne statement criticizing Russia on the 10th anniversary of its invasion of Georgia, a completely unforced error. Russia would have ignored it, but the Europeans noticed its absence and became even more concerned about American resolve. This was typical of Trump, who in June 2019 also blocked a draft statement on the 30th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacres and criticized the State Department for a press release issued before he knew about it. Trump seemed to think that criticizing the policies and actions of foreign governments made it harder for him to have good personal relations with their leaders. This was a reflection of his difficulty in separating personal from official relations. I'm not aware of any case where Russia or China refrained from criticizing the United States for fear of irritating our sensitive leaders. Trump's inconsistent views and decisions on Russia made all our work complicated, and cyber and non-cyber issues often bled into each other. Moreover, Establishing cyber deterrence was easier said than done, since almost all the cyber offensive operations we wanted to undertake necessarily remained classified. So, those directly affected would know they had been hit, but not necessarily by whom, unless we told them. Accordingly, there had to be some public discussion of our capabilities, to put our adversaries on notice that our years of passivity were over, and to reassure our friends that America was on the march in cyberspace. In late October, I made public remarks in Washington intended to convey in broad terms what we had done to eviscerate the Obama-era rules. Other administration officials, such as General Nakasone, did the same. This was a complicated field of decision, with difficult trade-offs between what to make public and what to keep classified. The more we could tell, the greater the deterrence we could establish in the minds of publics and decision-makers around the world. But unfortunately, the more we said publicly, the more we would reveal about capabilities that others could use to improve their own cyber programs, offensive and defensive. This is obviously an area of debate for future administrations. But whatever Trump's own personal attitude, we had done substantial work to protect U.S. elections from Russia and everyone else.